This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In December of 1931, a group of men and women were arrested at the Heart of New York Gymnasium for exercising in the buff. 24 seized in raid on nudist cult, read the New York Times headline. Shortly thereafter, the same newspaper reported that Judge Jonah Goldstein dismissed the charges against the so-called cult, stating that what is all right on the beach today would have meant arrest 3 years ago. It is a story told at the start of a new book called Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. And author Brian Hoffman joins us now with more. Brian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So your book is about American nudism, but nudism as a movement was largely exported to the U.S. from Germany. So give us a story there.
Sure. So in Germany, this has been happening as part of a larger movement called Lebensreform, which is this kind of return to nature. They believed in natural healing, they were against alcohol consumption, and they also believed that going naked was a way to return to nature.
And when was this?
1905 is, I think, the way most historians mark it, and it definitely is kind of what sparks these nudist camps that both develop in the German countryside, but also in the urban areas.
So what was going on in America in the late 20s and early 30s when this Heart of New York Gymnasium raid took place? What kind of cultural forces were paving the way for American nudism at that time?
In America, you're seeing this like gradual shift away from the moral absolutism of the 19th century, that the discussion of sex had to really be kept secret or repressed. This is moving away. We're starting to see a greater acceptance of birth control, of kind of titillating films, books dealing with controversial subjects are now being accepted. And so with this shift away from kind of sexual repression, you see people kind of open up to the idea of nudism in the United States. You start seeing books of travel narratives from Americans who have visited German camps become very popular. And then you have kind of German immigrants groups wanting to recreate the Nackt culture experience that they had enjoyed in Germany.
Nackt culture?
Nackt culture is like basically culture of the nude.
Mm-hmm.
And so they start developing these very small groups in kind of immigrant communities, New York City, Chicago. In America, though, it expands beyond that. So it becomes kind of a phenomenon where you have people from all walks of life choosing to go naked as a way of combating shame in America, but also promoting health.
Mm-hmm. This is at a time when there were a lot of reactionary movements to industrialism and urbanization in American life.
So, yes, during the Progressive Era, there's a great deal of concern about diseases of darkness, things like rickets or tuberculosis. Doctors would all the time send people out west to places like New Mexico and Arizona to have that dry climate, the exposure to the sun. So nudists build on that by removing the clothes in nudist camps, in gymnasiums. They not only soak up the sun and get vitamin D production going, which is supposed to be good for all different sorts of things, but also removing the clothes, allowing the glands, the sweat glands, to do what they're naturally supposed to do. And this becomes quite popular as nudists practice it, but also in the medical profession, and in hospitals would have solariums. So it's that kind of idea that the sun is a cure, that it is therapeutic, that allows nudists to kind of appeal to a whole segment of American society that's interested in natural healing and alternative medicine.
So that's what's going on socially. How about legally? What was the landscape for nudism in the 1930s?
Definitely legal history is part of what makes nudism possible. The American Civil Liberties Union are trying to open up expression in the United States, especially in the first decades of the 20th century. And nudism becomes part of that struggle. The first thing that kind of falls is like books with literary and scholarly merit, which is what really allows nudist books to be on the open market in the United States. But they do become embroiled in other cases because they walk this fine line of what is and isn't acceptable, what is illicit and what is respectable. And actually, that's one of the fascinating things to me about this movement. There are people who are sincerely about health and combating shame, but then there are others who are about also promoting the eroticism of the naked body to make a quick buck. But the line is never clear. And I think it speaks to the way Americans kind of understand the naked body, which is it has these contradictory and multiple functions of being about health and beauty and aesthetics, but also about eroticism and pornography. And so that line is a question that really challenges the courts from really the time nudism begins in the early 1930s all the way into the 1960s and 70s.
Well, let's talk about making a buck. Central to the nudism movement was this flagship magazine. It was called Sunshine and Health.
Yes.
Now, this is something that people gravitated toward because it did have, you know, photographs of naked people. But first, how important was this publication to organizing and actually promoting American nudism?
Yeah, it was really essential to putting nudism on the map in the United States. After these books kind of run their course, it's the magazine that allows the early nudist organizations to communicate about camps, about their philosophy, about what's happening in the movement. It is their internet of the day. So it was critical to establishing the movement in the United States. And the man who's really behind it is this guy. He's a fascinating character, the Reverend Illy Boone. And he is really critical to these magazines, fighting for the legal right to publish them, and then promoting them. They're really actually pretty beautiful magazines. They have wonderful covers. They're really highly and well-produced. But what you end up seeing is this kind of imbalance of pictures. Like on the cover, very attractive, usually female, sometimes families. And in the inside, you see this assortment of pictures that is much more, how do you say, honest to the nudist lifestyle.
Yeah, the post office didn't even want to deliver these magazines. I'm speaking with Brian Hoffman. He's author of the book Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism, which traces nudism from its roots in Germany to the rise of the family nudist resort and much beyond. So there is this undeniably erotic aspect to nudism. Now, how did that start to shape public perception about nudism during and after World War II, when there was a general sort of liberalization of the culture?
During the Second World War, because you have so many troops in all-male environments away from home, they become much more accepting of things like pinups.
Right. And Betty Grable is at everyone's bunk, right?
Yes, everyone. All these actresses, pinups everywhere, on airplanes, all over the place. And it's part of accepted is the culture. And so you get these reports from soldiers writing into Sunshine Health thanking them for making such a wonderful magazine that's circulating around the barracks. And the nudists reprint this in their magazines, and they're proud to be part of this war effort. It not only allows the nudist movement to kind of to support itself during the war through these magazines, but after the war, people are aware of the camps, and they want to see them. And so when they come back, you see an explosion of membership in nudist camps that I think is really growing out of the exposure nudism gained through the armed forces.
But you also have what you call the single man problem at these
Yes.
nudist resorts. Now, what is that exactly?
The single man problem definitely grows out of this popularity that these nudist magazines had during the Second World War. You get a lot of single men coming to these camps. But single men, they are somewhat suspect. They could be there to soak up the sun. On the other hand, they could also be there as voyeurs. They can be there to be looking for sexual, you know, trysts. They could be there to check out other men. And this was something that was a constant tension at many nudist camps, especially as they saw their membership skew heavily male. Mm-hmm. And it kind of threatened what nudism was all about during this period, which is about the family and mm-hmm. being heteronormative.
But it sounds kind of like a precursor to the kind of problems that many, you know, clubs have, nightclubs have had through the ages, and now dating sites are coping with very heavily male skewed.
Yes, absolutely. Like, these things attract the attention of men. And nudism was no exception, definitely a precursor to those kind of things where you have bars that, you know, attract women with, you know, free drinks and dating sites that give women extra freebies. I think, you know, whereas men have to pay for certain things, women don't have to pay to access different accounts. And nudist clubs were doing the same thing, that they would offer cheaper memberships for women or more expensive memberships for single men, that they had to carry their weight if they weren't bringing their family with them. In New Hampshire, there's Cedars Waters Village, and they still only allow couples. Mm-hmm. Like, that is their rule. Only men can come with when they're accompanied with women. That is largely faded from most camps nowadays. It's much more open. This is a privately held camp, and they've been around since 1950. And they're holding on to those kind of rules that were established in this post-war period.
Well, you know, I've been hearing about that camp my entire life growing up in New Hampshire. I think we all sort of get this idea about it, and it's, you know, tinged with this sense of illicitness. But you spoke to the kind of heteronormative formation of these camps, especially at that time. This was liberalization, I guess, on some level, but not quite. Still very family-centric. What was there a tension there?
Yes, there's an acceptance now that, you know, people have sex. You know, it is part of life. Men and women, people accept the dating culture. They accept that they're going to go to the movies, that there's this petting culture before marriage. But as long as that's kind of contained within the male-female relationship between marriage, ultimately resulting in a family and normalcy, then in American society, that type of sexuality is fine. What's not accepted are things that go against the grain, such as homosexual relationships, interracial intimacy, and a real kind of elephant in the room is the intergenerational sexuality or pedophilia, child molestation. These things raise major concerns, both within nudism, but also outside, people looking in at camps, like what's going on behind those walls, those fences.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. I'm speaking with Brian Hoffman. He's author of Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. And when we come back, we'll talk about how the sexual revolution of the 1960s fractured the nudist movement and where nudism stands today in the age of the selfie. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, speaking with Brian Hoffman, author of Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. Before the break, we talked with him about the origins of nudism as kind of a response to urban industrialization and the thin line that American nudists have walked between an ideology of physical well-being to the gradual exploitation and eroticization of nudism. In the post-World War II era, nudist camps flourished in rural settings across the United States, largely fleeing from persecution inside of urban centers. And in these camps, they were promoting a strictly heteronormative, family-oriented experience that excluded single men, homosexuals, and interracial relationships. How about the sexual revolution and the sort of hippie and free love movement in the 1960s? How did that change nudist culture?
Yes, the counterculture 1960s, it is really interesting. It was one of the things I enjoyed writing most about this book, is how fractured the movement becomes during this period. In the 1960s, there's this new generation that wants to use nudity, and specifically public nudity, to challenge what they see as being the hypocritical values of American society. So they no longer want to confine themselves to these camps. They want to be on the beach. They want to be in the park. And they want to have the right to kind of unclothe and to undress where and when they want as a way of being authentic. This is what the nudist movement then becomes, is this like loose assortment of organizations and groups and people that is much more confrontational about public nudity in a lot of different spaces. These nudists, these new generation of counterculture kind of hippies going naked, definitely conflict with an older generation that is much more about respectability and is not comfortable with the kind of erotic implications of the naked body.
So this is an academic book, and we never really get a sense of how you, Brian Hoffman, feel about nudism. So what made you want to write about this subject? Are you a nudist yourself?
Sure. I'm not a nudist. I actually think that's important. There's been a lot of people that have written from inside the movement and have provided us hagiographies of the movement, and those are fantastic. But I also thought it was good to have, like, step back and look at this movement as a historian. My personal interest, and it kind of comes from, like, unresolved questions of my own childhood, I think. I grew up with parents who were definitely hanging on to the counterculture a little bit too long. As a child, I was let free to roam the backyard completely naked. I grew up in this kind of funky neighborhood in Los Angeles called Mount Washington, and we would have block parties, and those were definitely clothing optional. And it was part of my childhood, going naked. In our photo album, there's all sorts of pictures that, you know, you probably don't want to show your girlfriend. But as I grew older, I realized that not everyone, all families were like this, that this was sort of odd. And this kind of, when I got into grad school and I was looking what to study, it was this question of why do Americans have this uncomfortable relationship with the body? You know, why is it so linked with shame? Why was my childhood so different? And I think as I stumbled across these nudist materials, it was a really great opportunity to answer that question, to use this kind of marginal oddball movement to look at how Americans have thought about the body, you know, over the course of the 20th century.
But how about today in this kind of super sexualized culture, a nude resort for adults anyway, seems almost, I don't know, quaint or for, you know, oddballs, I guess might be the reputation that goes on. But then again, there are still campaigns to free the nipple, you know, debates over public breastfeeding and laws that continue to make public nudity a criminal act. So has our culture's relationship with nudity changed all that much?
You know, I've been following the Free the Nipple campaign and a lot of the different things going on.
You should first tell people what it is, because I'm not sure everyone knows.
Sure. So there's been an effort by celebrities, but also everyday people, that women should have the right to kind of display their bodies in the same way a man is generally able to display his chest or torso. Mm-hmm. Whether they're on the beach or in their homes, or really it's on Facebook or Instagram. And what you're seeing is a different conversation emerging about what should and shouldn't be seen. We're no longer talking about judges or the government saying it's wrong or illegal to display your breasts on Facebook. It's Mark Zuckerberg. And I think that's different. When we are producing the content, when we are deciding to display it and we decide who our friends are, we feel that no company should tell us what we can and cannot show. So I think that's really different. The other thing that's going on, I think, in American society or even in the world, is the digitization of life has made us much more comfortable displaying our bodies. We take selfies now. These selfies are often of us on clothes. And because we don't have to worry about bringing them in to be developed anywhere, that they're ours, they're private, we keep them on our phones or on our computers, we've become comfortable with seeing our naked bodies and showing them. I don't think nakedness is as big a deal, especially for the younger digitized generation. And it's something that nudists have embraced. It's actually as strong a movement as it's ever been. It's a $400 million industry that is kind of accepting a tremendous growth in its membership at this point. There's all sorts of events, naked cycling movements and free the nipple, naked protests all the time. When I was in San Francisco, the Castro was having this debate about people going naked on the street there. And it wasn't a debate about completely banning it, but like having them bring their towels when they sit down. Hmm. So I do think things are shifting quite dramatically. The fact that these things are going on is, I think, a reflection that people's attitudes are changing.
Brian Hoffman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Brian Hoffman, he's author of Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. You'll find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for more Word of Mouth. Up next, from high-frequency calls emerging from the depths of the ocean to unexplained sonic booms, we're going to investigate the most mysterious sounds ever recorded. That's after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Unexplained phenomena often involve things that we can see but have no explanation for. UFOs or elaborate crop circles. Or why do some people think that dress is blue and black when it's clearly gold and white? But what about the things we can hear but have no explanation for? Producer Logan Shannon presents some audio mysteries.
In a normal radio story, I would either introduce a sound before playing it or play a sound and then immediately identify it. This is not a normal radio story. I have no idea what that is.
My name is Caitlin Schneider, and I'm a staff writer at Mental Floss.
Neither does Caitlin, though she does like to speculate. Caitlin is mildly obsessed with unexplained sounds, and she wrote about a few of her favorites for Mental Floss. And as is so often the case with radio producers, after I read her article, her mild obsession became mine. All right, let's take a closer listen to that sound I played a minute ago. It's called upsweep.
You can hear it's like a strange, it's called upsweep because it sort of has that like train of upsweeping sounds that last a couple seconds.
Okay, that is pretty weird. But how do they even record these unexplained sounds in the depths of the sea? Well, in 1991, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration started conducting underwater surveillance. They planted water-tolerant microphones called hydrophones all along the ocean and then pressed record. Upsweep has been there from the beginning. After all these years of recording this absolutely bizarre sound, there must be some theories, but what do scientists think it is?
It's always there. They don't know what it is. The leading theory is that it has something to do with volcanic activity, but they don't really know for sure. If I were to just listen to that clip, that's certainly not what would come to mind. As all of these ocean sounds, I think a creature is, because it just sounds so spooky and like something lurking in the deep and probably like something we've never seen before.
Upsweep is a spooky sound, but not as spooky as the unexplained sound from the ocean known as Julia. Okay, that is way stranger than upsweep. Is it an animal we've never heard of, like searching for a mate, or a ghost submarine left over from the war, or maybe something alien?
Julia is sort of, in some ways, a creepy one because there's so little information about it. It lasts about 15 seconds. As you can hear, there's sort of that one part where there's sort of a distinct cry sound. You can hear something that sounds sort of like a wail. And it was loud enough that it was picked up by the entire hydrophone array.
Not all mysteries of the sea are the stuff of nightmares. Some are just sad.
It begins back in 1989 when the U.S. Navy first heard a mysterious sound picked up on the top secret network of underwater microphones that had been used to track Russian submarines ever since the Cold War. Scientists deduced this mysterious sound was coming from one single whale who had been calling out at 52 hertz, a frequency that no other whale could understand. Now it's believed that this whale has lived his entire life in complete solitude, swimming all alone through the Pacific, calling out, yet never once receiving a response, earning him the nickname, the loneliest whale in the world.
That's Adrien Grenier of Entourage fame and his partner, Josh Zeman, telling this sad and mysterious story of 52, the loneliest whale. They successfully raised over $400,000 with the help of 3,800 backers to go in search of this creature. Caitlin is among the many people that are hopeful they will successfully find more information on the loneliest whale.
Its call is not like any other whale, and therefore it sort of roams the ocean alone and is really sad and lonely. And I love this one because it's different from the others in that it's not scary, but it's just so strange to think that this enormous animal is wandering the ocean by itself.
While the ocean seems to be the primary source of unexplained sounds, there are a few sounds on Caitlin's list that you might get a chance to hear without the help of an underwater hydrophone array, like the hum. People have reported hearing this mysterious sound across the globe for years. The sound even made its way to a baseball game in Florida.
And the bunt is foul. The count is 1-1.
What could that possibly be? Somebody shut the door.
It sounds supernatural.
That recording was taken at Tropicana Field during a game between the Tampa Bay Rays and the Detroit Tigers back in the summer of 2001.
Bringing out all the stops tonight in order to take down Verlander.
I haven't heard anything that bad since we had that Vuvuzela night.
The same week, an earthquake measuring 5.8 on the Richter scale hit the East Coast, which some propose might be the source of the sound.
Just as we mentioned that, it stops. Maybe we figured it out.
According to a field reporter who was at the game, the noise was feedback from speakers that were hit by a direct lightning strike. For most of these unexplained sounds, science can provide a perfectly logical explanation for a possible origin, but rarely is there any proof. It's easy to find people who have alternate theories for where these sounds come from, but that's an entirely different kind of internet rabbit hole. Despite the difference of opinions, for Caitlin, seeking out unexplained sounds and trying to figure out where they come from continues to be a favorite distraction.
It's a different kind of way of seeing wonder in the world that I think is not generally thought of. You know, strange sounds are not the sort of mysteries that we usually turn our focus to, and I think when you start thinking about it, it does sort of become one of those things that starts to pop up in your mind that wasn't there before.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Logan Shannon.
And you can listen to more unexplained sounds and read a few theories by following the links at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And the mysteries continue. This time, a granite wall, a statue, and a gust of wind in Sandwich, New Hampshire. Completed in 1875, the Great Wall of Sandwich is a shoulder-height granite wall that runs more than a mile. Together with its 7-foot-tall statue of Niobe, the Great Wall became something of a tourist attraction in the early 20th century. But in 1941, a hurricane toppled the statue, and its shattered pieces went missing for nearly 70 years. NHPR's Sean Hurley recently visited Sandwich to learn more about the wall and find out how Niobe was finally recovered.
Boone Porter is a retired lawyer. He lives on Wentworth Hill in a white-pillared Greek Revival house that once belonged to the actor Claude Rains.
I've always felt this town had more than its fair share of dreamers, you know, people who come here and they somehow feel that the unique attributes of this town will somehow allow those dreams to come true.
One of the earliest homegrown dreamers was Isaac Adams, born in 1802.
Isaac Adams grew up here in Sandwich as a printer's apprentice. He was not doing well, and he was not popular, and he decided that he would go to Boston where he could make his fortune. And he went around to his neighbors and asked if they would lend him the money for the stagecoach fare down to Boston.
No one lent the unpopular 22-year-old a penny.
And Mr. Adams took great umbrage at that insult and vowed to return to Sandwich as a very successful person with enough money to buy any property that he wanted.
Adams made his own way to Boston, and 4 years later, in 1828,
he invented the Adams Steam Press, which revolutionized printing.
The Adams Press would dominate the print world for the rest of the century and made Isaac Adams a fortune.
And at some point, he decided to retire back to Sandwich, his hometown.
It was 1861, and Adams returned with a vengeance.
He bought up all the small farms in Sandwich and proceeded to knock them down. And he built the Great Wall, paid a very good wage to approximately 100 laborers who worked at it for 2 years.
Adams lived on top of Wentworth Hill in a mansion cobbled together from bits and pieces of surrounding farms, a private Xanadu that featured a windmill, barns, stables, gardens, a bowling alley, and a locally quarried granite wall that ran for more than a mile.
The Great Wall of Sandwich is a little bit like the Great Wall of China. It's not just a single structure. It's actually several different structures.
On the most visible section of the Great Wall, Adams installed the statue of Niobe. According to Greek mythology, Niobe was punished by Apollo for excessive pride in her children. And most people believe Isaac Adams' message was clear. He was Apollo, and the citizens of Sandwich were the proud, and now punished, Niobe. Though Isaac Adams died in 1883, this insult by statuary, as Sandwich resident Adam Nutt Homeyer calls it, lived on until a 1941 hurricane knocked Niobe off her 18-foot-high pedestal.
She was shattered into 150 pieces. So over 7 decades, people had shepherded and stewarded these pieces and kept them hidden, and most people thought it was lost for good, just lost to time and just disappeared. And so did I.
But Boone Porter didn't think so. As a part owner of the Great Wall, he had rights to the shattered zinc metal shards of Niobe, wherever she may be. And in 2005, after a year-long search for the missing pieces, he finally got lucky.
The pieces had been found by this tenant in an old, dilapidated horse barn buried under a pile of manure.
Porter spent the next few years trying to find someone to restore Niobe. One conservator gave him an estimate of $250,000. Another suggested he sell the zinc metal pieces for scrap.
Not sure what to do. I did nothing and just left the pieces in my barn.
After moving to Sandwich in 2010, with a dream of becoming a blacksmith, Adam Nutt Homeyer walked across the street to pay his new neighbor, Boone Porter, a visit.
And he asked if I could give him a tour of our barn. And he saw all the pieces of the statue and went, "Holy smokes, what's that?"
Like most people, Nutt Homeyer had never restored a statue in his life, but...
And he said, "Will you allow me to give you a bid to put it together? Because I think I can."
During the summer of 2011, Nutt Homeyer assembled the 150-piece metal jigsaw of Niobe, finishing just in time for her to be unveiled at Sandwich's 250th anniversary in 2012.
I doubt there was anybody, I don't care how famous and skilled they are, that could have done a better job. I just don't believe there is such a person.
Porter takes me on a walk around the various sections of the wall, dispelling rumors about Isaac Adams as we go.
There's a myth that Isaac Adams dumped salt in the little pond to try to farm lobsters. I think that's just a myth.
There's a myth that Adams used to ride his carriage on top of the 10-foot wide wall.
Which is utter nonsense because, as you see, there are breaks in the wall which he couldn't traverse.
What's not utter nonsense are Isaac Adams' pair of old Mosler safes, each the size of a dishwasher, blown open and rusting in the woods.
And why they're there, we don't know.
But Porter does know why the traffic on Little Pond Road has increased. With Niobe back in place, high atop the Great Wall,
we get a rather steady procession of cars that come and slow down and stop and look and take pictures. And there you are.
And there Niobe and the Great Wall are, a once and future tourist attraction made of granite, spite, zinc metal, a Greek myth, 100 laborers, a hurricane, a blacksmith, a pile of money, and a patchwork of dreams. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Up next, from the tricky art of restoring a historical statue to its former glory, we move to the complicated process of restoring law and order in the virtual world. What happens when a real robbery goes down in a video game? We'll find out after a short break. In 2002, two young men committed a number of robberies, stealing and eventually selling more than $8,000 worth of weapons and other equipment. It wasn't an ordinary B&E, though. These crimes were committed entirely online, inside the popular 2012 video game Diablo III. Understanding how to prosecute crimes that take place in digital world is complicated. For example, should the theft of virtual equipment in an online game be a felony? Or should it be considered more leniently than robberies committed in what we conventionally call real life? Kashmir Hill is senior editor at Fusion's Real Future column, where she wrote about how prosecutors dealt with the case and joins us now for more. Kashmir, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So how exactly did these two young men rob other players in the game?
So the way that they did this is one of them was in California, the other one was in Maryland, and they had met through a gaming chat platform called TeamSpeak. And the one in California named Patrick apparently hatched this plan. And the way that it would work is that he bought something called a RAT, a remote access tool. And he and his colleague in Maryland named Michael would send players in the game a link. And they said, oh, this is an image of a really rare item in the game. You should click on it. And when other players clicked on the link, they would download this RAT. And the RAT would let Patrick take over control of their computer. Mm. He would go in, he would take over their video game character and get it to start shaking so it dropped all of its goods. And then Michael would be hanging out nearby in his character form, and then he would swoop in and grab the items that had just been dropped, and so they would essentially steal them. Then Diablo, this particular video game, was kind of rare in that it had an in-game marketplace where you could buy and sell the weapons and armor and gold for the in-game currency or for real money. So according to prosecutors, they then took these weapons and armor to the marketplace, and they would sell it for real money. And according to prosecutors, they made over $8,000 this way.
How did law enforcement then get involved?
So the people who were playing Diablo started complaining to Blizzard, the entertainment company that runs this game, saying, hey, you know, something weird just happened. I dropped all of my goods, and I think I got hacked. Somebody stole my stuff. And so Blizzard went to the prosecutors.
And Blizzard is the maker of the game.
It's the maker of the game. And they said, hey, something weird is happening here. They were actually able to very easily, unlike victims of crime in the real world, Blizzard was able just to recreate the digital goods that had been stolen from these people. So they weren't really victims in that way, in that they immediately got their stolen stuff back. Mm-hmm. But prosecutors still considered this a crime, you know, a virtual theft, and were especially concerned about the use of this hacking tool, the RAT.
But there were still consequences. What happened to Michael and Patrick?
So they were identified. I'm still a little hazy on how the FBI figured out who they were. It may have been Blizzard itself because they would have IP information. But the prosecutors in LA filed charges against both of these players. And the kind of big charge that stuck was for unauthorized access to computers. So they said, oh, you know, you shouldn't have been accessing other players' computers. And then basically any crime that touches a computer server, a company's server, so in this case Blizzard's, when you do something wrong, it becomes unauthorized access. Mm-hmm. So rather than being charged with robbery or assault, which they were doing virtually, they were charged with unauthorized access. And then both of these guys ended up accepting plea deals where they have to pay back Blizzard 3 years of probation. And in one case, the guy in Maryland had to do community service.
In the scale of American crimes, $8,000 may not be that much, but it's a really interesting case in that it's happening in the virtual world. Yet the case didn't get any real press back in 2012. Do you have any idea why?
I'm not sure why it didn't get attention. I mean, I just kind of make a habit of calling prosecutors and asking about interesting cases, so it came onto my radar. And the two men involved were, you know, these are guys, they're like young guys in their 20s, were really surprised that I found it, that the court records were available. But, you know, even though it was just a virtual theft, they both are now felons. When they apply for a job, they have to admit that they have criminal records and explain that they were, you know, stealing virtual goods from somebody.
Patrick declined to speak to you, but you did speak with Michael Stinger. Did you get a sense of, besides having a tough time having a job, whether he felt any remorse for what he did or what he thought of his punishment?
People always have complicated stories. He says that they never actually were able to sell their goods. He said that they did not, in fact, make $8,000 because Blizzard pretty quickly realized what was happening and basically shut them out of the game. So they couldn't sell the digital booty that they had accumulated. So that was interesting. But, you know, I think he feels really scarred by this whole thing, that he thought he was just in a game. He says he didn't know that his accomplice in this was actually hacking people's computers. He thought it was just a glitch in the game and, you know, goods were falling on the ground and then he was getting to collect them. And that's what you do in these games. You're fighting with people. You're trying to get their goods. So I think for him, those lines had really blurred between what's allowed in the game world and what's okay in real life. And I think this is something that always happens. This is why people can be so mean online and mm-hmm. say horrible things to each other, because you don't think about it as real life.
Well, there are so many other crimes related to online gaming. We think of swatting, you know, where gamers call SWAT teams on others and watch the drama unfold on camera. Many threats against female gamers and game critics. Any sense, Kashmir, of how law enforcement is planning to prosecute these kind of online crimes and investigate them?
I think it's difficult when the people who commit the online crimes are savvy about disguising who they really are, because there are so many tools out there that can make it very difficult to track down who did it. And it varies from prosecutor office to prosecutor office, but they still don't see, you know, online crimes as concerning as ones that affect us in the real world. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to like psychological effects, prosecutors, when they're looking at cases, usually are more concerned when there's a financial aspect to the case where people have actually lost money. And so they tend to take those cases over ones where people have just suffered psychological harm. So that's really been difficult in terms of these harassment cases online.
So the Diablo robbery was in 2012, finally prosecuted in 2014. What do you think? You're in this field. Do you see these kinds of prosecutions becoming more common, or are we still a long ways away from really knowing how to deal with online crime?
We're spending more and more of our time online, and so more crimes are starting to be committed there. And I do see law enforcement being interested in that. Law enforcement sees crimes moving online and they're trying to follow them there. They just are, it takes them a while. So they're a few years behind, But I suspect that we will see more cases like this one that seem kind of weird and novel now. But, you know, it'll become more normal, especially, you know, video games are big business. Video game players can make a lot of money. And so it can really hurt them financially when they're swatted in the middle of a match, or when, you know, the servers are DDoSed because somebody is trying to throw a match. So I do suspect we will see more weird online crimes like this being prosecuted.
Well, I guess we'll be speaking with you again then, Kashmir.
I hope so.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Kashmir Hill, she's senior editor at Fusion's Real Future column. You can read her article about the Diablo 3 prosecutions at wordofmouthradio.org. We thank you so much for your listening time today. Earlier in the show, we talked about some of the most mysterious sounds ever recorded. And you can listen to those unexplained sounds and read a few theories by following the links at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. And if you like it, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.